Hi folks, I am recording this on a Thursday afternoon when I am looking very unusually presentable. I actually had to go and do something face-to-face today, which is kind of unusual for me these days. So I thought that whilst I'm maybe a little more, a little more presentable than usual, for those of you on the video, I'll do this. I don't think it really matters. It's the same content, but hey, it's a little bit of a change of pace. Regardless, I want to jump into what for me was the story of the week, possibly the story of many, many weeks, which is the one I alluded to last week around the pathology reports for this Indian website. Now, this website is called, or rather the company who has a website, is called Health Solutions. Now, the solution that Health Solutions came up with in order to distribute their pathology reports to, well, kind of to everyone, was to put them in a folder with no access controls and directory listing enabled. So 43,203 files sitting in this folder. Now, I mentioned a little bit about it last week. I couldn't name who it was because I was still trying to get it cleaned up. And the problem I was having was that no one was answering my contact attempts. So email was bouncing back. No one was responding to the contact us form. Who is details? Mail was bouncing back from those guys as well. I was trying to get people in India, in Mumbai, where these guys are based, to give them a call and say, hey, your data's kind of all out there, kind of leaking. I eventually got a BuzzFeed reporter. And this guy was great, really good. He got in touch with them. And he got some comments. Now, I'm going to link to this blog post in the notes for this recording here. And you might want to go and read it all in detail, but particularly for those of you listening to this on the podcast, I know a lot of people just listen to the audio, may be driving, may not have access to the PC. Let me give you the highlights because this is just absolutely mind-boggling. So the BuzzFeed reporter has gotten in touch with Health Solutions. And the guy from Health Solutions, first of all, has said, we are not the doctors. We and our franchisees merely do the blood tests, and maintaining doctor-patient confidentiality is not our problem. So have a think about this for a moment, because what the guy is saying is, we went and did all of these pathology tests which were requested by the doctor. We whacked them all in a folder share. Anyone could download them, but this is not doctor-patient confidentiality. I mean, what the hell was he thinking? So anyway, he said that. Now, this is where it gets, every time you think it can't get worse, it gets worse. So the next thing he does is he says, look, we are moving to a new domain in January and retiring the existing website, so these problems will be fixed in Jan. Now, he said that on the 1st of December. So he's saying, don't worry about it, we're going to leave this stuff exposed for at least a month. And his next quote is, but till then, we are not planning to do anything about this. Now, this is what it sounds like. This is personal health reports, okay? So tests, blood tests for things like everything from does the fetus of a pregnant lady possibly have signs of Down syndrome? Does this individual have HIV? You know, this is the level of tests. And we know that there were tests for things like HIV because, as I show in the blog post, without downloading anyone's files, you can just do a Google search because Google has indexed it. So you could do a Google search for in URL and then the path where they were and then give it a space, HIV. And you would see previews of the documents which would show not only the person's name and their age and other person identifiable data, but the results of their HIV tests. And this is the stuff these guys are saying they're not going to remove. It gets worse. It goes on. BuzzFeed obviously did look at some documents, and they've come back and said some of the people in there were as young as 17. They've also said Health Solutions told them that they had been hacked several times. Now, I'll come back to that because we learn more about that a little bit later on. Health Solutions also said the data leak was 6 months ago, and by now we already have a new server. Obviously, that server not so well configured. A few other things in here. Let me get to the interesting bits here. The Health Solutions spokesperson says the lab's website was developed by a third-party developer that he described as a personal friend. Now, for those of us working in technology, how many times have you heard someone say, yeah, I got this website developed by this friend's daughter's cousin's best friend's dog, or whatever, right? Like some personal nepotistic relationship where someone does a little bit of web development on the side. And all the dots start to join now because you're going, well, hang on a second, like no wonder it was so badly done. He's gone out and just found someone who's convenient. And then as we go on, I've sort of pulled this apart and figured out that it's someone who has just finished university who's built this. Look, the poor guy probably doesn't know what he's gotten himself into. He's bitten off more than he can chew. We've found a bunch of other websites sitting there on the same IP address. Absolutely nothing to do with the whole context of pathology reports. And then as I've pulled this apart even further, I have found a remote shell which has infected the machine. So someone has uploaded a shell which was called, what did they call this one? I can't remember what they called it. But it's a freaking remote shell. Either way, like this is kind of not what you want. So anyway, they had this remote shell running on their machine, which was really not good because a remote shell, in fact, this particular one then has access to a whole bunch of commands that'll do things like let you run arbitrary SQL, do port scanning, send mails, just nasty, nasty stuff. And I'll leave you with this bit. And this is sort of the big takeaway as to how this went so bad. And I've got this here in bold text on the blog post. Health Solutions hired a personal friend fresh out of school working for himself to manage tens of thousands of pathology reports on his own server he hosted in a foreign country. I didn't mention that. It was running in the US as well. So Indian nationals' health reports put in a totally different country. In a different country, along with a bunch of other unrelated sites that was infected with a malicious shell. Now, after that went out and they got a bit of pressure, a little bit of social pressure, the thing got shut down. And in fact, after BuzzFeed ran their story, it got shut down. I didn't write about it until all the documents were removed and I found that they were gone from Google Cache. And I think that's important for me from an ethical perspective because I don't want to make other people's data available. I think BuzzFeed probably wrote about it a little bit earlier, but a little bit too early. The thing is that there is a very different social tolerance in India to what we have in many other parts of the world. And what I mean by that is that if this was Australia or the UK or the US and we found exposed health data, it would just be like, shut this stuff down as fast as we possibly can. Make it go away. In India and in many emerging markets, it just doesn't have the same priority. They've got other really serious life-impacting things to deal with, like poverty and disease and literacy and issues like that. So I guess we've got to keep in mind a little bit that they do have a different set of priorities. They do look at things a little bit differently to us. However, this is an example of how badly it can go wrong. So go and read that. That, to me, is going to be a bit of a poster story for how much sensitive information you can expose and not care about it for quite some time to come. So that was that one. I wrote about that on Monday. Now, a little bit later on, I wrote something different, and I wrote for my Security Sense column. And what I wanted to talk about here was how well websites protect their customers who have been compromised in other data breaches. And this was in response to a couple of incidents. One was MailChimp seeing a lot of accounts compromised. And the other one was the National Lottery in the UK seeing lots of compromises. Now, particularly after the second one, I did some interviews with the BBC. And one of the comments I made, and they were asking quite specifically about this, is how responsible is the National Lottery if attackers have logged on to users' accounts on the National Lottery which they've taken from other systems. So they didn't say it in particular, but imagine it was LinkedIn. Okay, so LinkedIn got compromised, 160-odd million accounts exposed, weekly stored passwords. You've now got a bunch of email addresses and easily cracked passwords that you could go and try on other websites. And this is this credential stuffing behavior that we see. So let's imagine someone's taken that and tried to log on to the National Lottery website. And the National Lottery has said there were 26,500 logins that were essentially fraudulent. And I made the comment that, look, even though the National Lottery says that it kind of wasn't their fault, and it kind of wasn't, right? Like, this is password reuse. I made the comment that they still allowed people to log in 26,500 times with stolen credentials. Now, we've got to sort of put this in perspective a little bit, because it is a hard problem. And the reason I wrote the Security Sense piece was I think it's a good discussion to talk about how do we defend against attackers with legitimate credentials. And I often talk about this in the workshops I run as well. I put this question to people. So think about it like this, 26,500 successful logins. There would have been many unsuccessful logins, many, many times more than that, either because the credentials were incorrect for the user that existed on the National Lottery, or an attacker was trying email addresses / usernames that just simply didn't exist at all. So be generous and say there are only 100,000 attempted logins. There's a really interesting question to be asked here, and I don't necessarily have all the answers, but I think it's a good discussion, about how do you protect malicious attempts to log in possibly hundreds of thousands of times? How do you stop this? And look, there are a number of different things we can do here. I mean, obviously, we can try and get people to use multi-step verification. That's not particularly effective because people don't like doing it. But we can look at things like heightened rates of failed logins. You're not going to be able to try and log in 100,000 times and fail on anything other than a really large website without that being an unusual traffic pattern. Now, should a traffic pattern like that possibly increase the level of suspicion to the point where we get a capture or some other form of anti-automation on the page? Maybe not a bad idea, because that many logins would have been done by automation. Should we see something like Google's new invisible recapture? I tweeted about this earlier on in the week. I'm going to put it on Have I Been Pwned soon as well. So some form of anti-automation that should not cause friction for legitimate users, but should stop the bots. Now, a few people responded to me and went, well, hang on a second, like, this isn't the National Lottery's problem, right? Like, why should they have to protect against the fact that their customers have reused their credentials? And I totally get that. It's not the National Lottery's fault. I think the interesting thing for them to think about is, even for their own best interests, does it make sense to try and limit this behavior? You're not going to be able to stop it, but you're going to be able to limit it. Because inevitably, they have now had to go back to 26,500 people and say, your account got owned. Here's how to change your credentials. Okay, not a biggie. But you may find that they now have to go back and do things like recovery of funds. That gets expensive. There is reputation damage. Not their fault, but they're still in the headlines as having been hacked. So there are many reasons why there is a vested interest in these organizations trying to stop this sort of thing from happening. And I guess the final takeaway from this is that if your entire authentication process is nothing more than there's an HTTP post with a username and a password, do they match? You're going to have these sorts of problems. So that was that one. Now, another one. I did this Have I Been Pwned Ask Me Anything, which I've been talking about for a while. This is part of the third birthday celebrations of Have I Been Pwned, and it all went pretty well. So I used YouTube Live. I set the whole thing up. I started talking probably 5 minutes before schedule just to make things work. I had a bunch of people join. I always had somewhere between about the 80-90 range of people currently online watching it. I spoke for about 2 hours, so I assume plenty of people dropped off and others came on. I got lots of interesting questions. I learned a few things along the way. I learned something I already knew, which is my bandwidth sucks and my upspeed was kind of crap. So the bit of video I did at the start didn't work so well, didn't sync so well with the audio. So that's a note for next time. I had my mate Scott Helm do comment moderation, which was really good. There were a couple of nut jobs who snuck in. You wouldn't believe this, but there are a lot of nut jobs on the internet. So a couple of nut jobs, he kept them out, which was good. And that's the nice thing about moderation. You just mute them, ban them, kick them out, and you focus on the good things. So he sorted that out. That was good. And I got some good questions. And then what I did towards the end of it, right at the tail end, in fact, is I published a blog post where I made 1.4 billion records from Have I Been Pwned available for analysis. Now, what I actually did is I took all of the records in the system, which is almost 2 billion, and then I distilled that down to just the unique email addresses in the system, which was then sort of 1.5 something billion. And I then removed all the ones that only appeared in a sensitive data breach. And in fact, I took out all the sensitive data breaches altogether. And what I eventually boiled it down to was 1.4 billion rows that explained which sites an account had been compromised in. I obviously don't display the account. So say my record, I've been in 8 different breaches. You don't see my email address, you don't see my domain. All you see is a row with my 8 different unique sites on it. So I took those and then I aggregated them, because there are a bunch of people that were, say, only in the LinkedIn data breach. There's like 100 million of those rows only showed LinkedIn. So instead of having 100 million rows, it's just one row that says LinkedIn, and then there's the 100 million next to it, the number. So effectively, it's a group by. And that was really good. I wanted to put that out there to give people data that they could analyze and do interesting things with, because I kept getting requests to do this, and I was always reluctant to give anybody anything because of the privacy risks. So instead of sort of saying no to everyone or trying to do this on a case-by-case basis, I sat down, deduped as much as I could, produced it all, put it up there. It's now pretty extensively torrented, distills down to something like 13 megabytes by the time it's all zipped as well. And I'm seeing some really, really neat analytics done out of it. So there's a couple of dashboards in particular people have done that are really cool, and they show the associations between data breaches. So they've got lines going everywhere, and they're sort of showing here's how people appear in sort of clusters of breaches. And you can start to draw some interesting insights into that. So that was really good. I'm glad I made that data available, and I'm glad people are doing some cool stuff, and I hope we see a lot more as time goes by. Last thing, I did a blog post just today. I'm actually recording this on a Thursday afternoon, my time. So maybe my bandwidth will let me get this up a bit earlier this time. And I did this blog post on CSP, Content Security Policy. And the blog post was all about how I screwed it up. And in fact, I will take some blame. The title of it was How Chrome's Buggy Content Security Policy Implementation Cost Me Money. And as much as I'm taking some blame, there was a bug in Chrome. And here's what happened. I've got this donate page on Have I Been Pwned? Because unbeknownst to me, some people actually want to send me money for something I give them for free. So that's cool. I did the donate page. And there's these buttons you go down and click on in order to donate me, say, some beer or coffee or something like that. And what happens is you click on the button, you fill in some stuff on Have I Been Pwned, you click submit, and it makes an HTTP post that targets blank, so it opens in a new tab, to PayPal. Now, I tested this on my machine, okay, and it worked. But what I later discovered is that people with Firefox or other non-Chrome browsers that still implement CSP, so that's mostly Firefox, what they were finding was that when they clicked the button that should have made the form post to PayPal, nothing was happening. It was breaking. Long story short, what we worked out is that Chrome had a bug. And the bug in Chrome was that it wasn't applying the CSP for the form-action directive when it targeted blank. Now, that sounds kind of niche, but what it meant was that I did the whole donations thing and I tested it in every browser. All right. Certainly, I tested it in, I'd normally test in Chrome, Firefox, and IE. You know, we now covered most of them. I'll fire it up in the iPhone and then it gets tested on Safari as well. So I did that. And I did that when I initially implemented the donations page a couple of years ago. No dramas, worked fine. Earlier this year, I added the form action CSP directive. I didn't have it there before. Now, when I added that, I would have tested it in Chrome. And I didn't go through and test in the other browsers. Now, this is the bit that's my fault. I screwed this up, and I've got to acknowledge that. I didn't test in the other browsers. The reason I didn't test in the other browsers is I hadn't changed anything at all on the UI. I thought that this was, okay, I was going to say server-side control. It's not a server-side control. It is something that I implemented on the server side to return the response headers, which is then a client-side control. Now, that's where I went wrong, because I should have tested the other browsers. It has no rendering impact or anything like that. It's not going to change my CSS or my JavaScript. but I didn't test it on the other ones. Because I only tested it in Chrome, and because I didn't actually implement an explicit form action CSP that allowed PayPal, I had the problem. So go through and read it, because, you know, again, and I've said this multiple times, but I have to say it again because a few people have called me on it. I didn't test it. However, it is interesting to look at just how many bugs and idiosyncratic behavior browsers display with CSPs. It's not just this one. Safari, if you put a frame on a page, Safari expects you to talk about frame source. Frame source as a directive is not part of the spec. The spec is child source. So if you go and put an iframe on your page and you go and you read the W3C spec and you get your CSP spot on and you allow child sources but you don't allow frame sources, Safari may not load your content. I learned that the hard way. Last year, I think it was. It was quite a while back. Because this is another idiosyncratic implementation of CSP. And the bigger picture here is that CSPs are meant to break your things under certain conditions. They're meant to break your things when your things are attempting to load something that they shouldn't. So that's their very nature. And that the problem with that is that if you screw up your CSP, you can break things that aren't meant to be broken. Not just if you screw up your CSP, if the browser screws up their CSP implementation. So what all of this means is that you've got to be really, really careful with CSP because it's so easy for them to go wrong. And it pains me to say it because you can do really cool things with them, but just be really, really careful. I would probably recommend now for organizations that they try and dip the toe into the water with CSPs very gently. You don't necessarily have to start blocking content. You could just do things like upgrade insecure requests. I've written about that before. So let's just sort of force everything to be secure on an HTTPS-only site. Block mixed content, another good example. If there's any mixed content, you could just go, all right, well, just block it. That sort of stuff is kind of neat. The other takeaway from it is that you've really got to watch your CSP reports. You can define a report URI in your CSP so that you get a report sent to your server if it's violated. I should have been watching that, and I wasn't. Part of the reason I wasn't is because it is really noisy. You get so much crap back from CSP reports. All of this together just means be careful. It's still not a really consistently implemented mechanism by the browsers. We're still seeing a few screwy things. We still need it to evolve further. CSPs are awesome. Proceed with caution. Final thing. Sponsor this week is Terbium Labs, and Terbium do some dark web intelligence things. They're back for this week, though they were there last week as well. I've now filled out all my sponsor slots into April as well, which is kind of cool. So once again, we're not going to see any of the traditional tracking iframe nasty kind of ads there for probably forever, which is nice. So thanks very much for watching. I know these are getting longer. I just seem to have more and more stuff that happens each week. And I appreciate everyone giving me your feedback both on the video and on the podcast. Thanks, folks.